Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Montgomery. My firm represents the appellant and cross-appellee Randon II LLC and its principal Richard Stonard. My attorney registration number is 44039. Randon II raises a narrow issue under the Recording Act. The trial court held that a notice of dispendence relates back to the date of filing for the purposes of determining priority under the recording statute. The application of the relation back doctrine contradicts the plain language of the notice of dispendence statute and the recording statute. And in a recent case, this court held that the relation back doctrine defeats the very purpose of Colorado's race notice statute.
Mr. Montgomery, at the risk of getting sidetracked, I'm having a hard time understanding why there is even a dispendence in existence in this case. And I need you to help me and opposing counsel to help me understand that. As I understand the plaintiff's claim, she was not seeking any interest in the real property. She was seeking to set aside a transfer between two other people of real property, I suppose so she could collect damages against one of them, attach the property perhaps in satisfaction of that. So how does, after the judgment, why does the dispendence, I'm not sure why it existed before because she wasn't seeking interest in real property, why does it still exist? Why shouldn't it just be taken off the records?
Well, the notice of dispendence, why does it exist?
It exist now after judgment? I mean, she did not get awarded an interest in the real property. Even if she had, that would have taken care of the reason for filing the dispendence. The dispendence itself would have gone away.
Well, she was awarded a first position in one of the properties at issue by the judgment, a second position in one of the other properties.
It seemed like the position is based upon the dispendence, but a dispendence is not a lien against property.
Right, but I think that the trial judge was under the impression that a dispendence was a lien against property.
But as a matter of law, that's incorrect.
Right.
So we're supposed to just say, because the judge was incorrect, we have to treat the dispendence as a lien?
No.
I mean, it's not a lien. So how can it be a position, first, second, or otherwise? A dispendence exists because you're informing the world that there is an action that might affect title to real property.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, but that's all it is. It is not itself the claim to real property. Those claims must exist independently, and you must prove them. So did the plaintiff prove that she had an interest in the real property aside from the dispendence, which are not interests in the time?
Now that you mention it, I don't believe that she did establish that there was
an interest
in the property.
They're not liens as a matter of law. That's what's messing me up in this whole case.
But in any event, I would suggest that our client did establish his interest in the property and that he is entitled to priority of those interests in the property, either through the Recording Act, the way the judge entered it, entertain the question, or simply as a result of the verdict that he was awarded an interest. I think the judge erroneously decided after the initial trial that the notice of a dispendence was a lien and analyzed much of it in that case. And then we filed a motion to amend, basically pointing out that wasn't the case law. And that's what caused him to go to this relation back doctrine. Obviously, we didn't think that was correct either, but you only get one shot on a motion to amend, and so now we're here.
And plaintiff or Ms. Horan had no security interest in this property once it was transferred to the debtor, isn't that correct? She had no security interest in it.
I think that's correct, although she may disagree. I mean, she did maintain a promissory note that.
Right, but unsecured.
But I believe it was an unsecured promise.
Yeah, there was no mortgage or deed of trust or anything against the property.
I believe that's correct.
Pardon me, Mr. Montgomery.
Yes.
As I looked at the record, it was my understanding that the theory here was that if I'm mispronouncing her name, I'm sure I'll be corrected, but Ms. Horan took the position that I'm owed $550,000. I need to be able to have that satisfied. It is my position that Tricord transferred this to Brandon II, and that was a fraudulent transfer. That's her position. And therefore, I'm going to have that set aside because this particular piece of property I'm going to use that to satisfy my $550,000. Was that Ms. Horn's argument below?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. All right, what I wanted to point out, and I mean, it sounds like maybe you're thinking about this case in a different way, but at least I did want to point out that since we had filed our last brief, the Goodman case, the Supreme Court denied cert in that case, and that order can be found at 2002 WL 583-5532, and the case was published at 292 Pacific 3rd 1060. And at least as the trial court framed the issue and as we framed the issue on appeal, I believe that the Goodman case is dispositive of the issue, and it's holding that the relation back doctrine defeats the very purpose of the Recording Act.
Well, let me ask another question about the Recording Act, if I may.
Sure.
Did Ms. Horn have actual notice of Brandon II's interest in the property and the transfer between Tricord and Brandon II at the time that she filed the lease pendants? Isn't that why the lease pendants was filed?
I think she would have to have actual notice since she filed the complaint with the intention of setting aside the transaction. And so it would seem that if she wanted to set aside the transaction, it follows as a matter of logic that she was aware of the transaction. The other thing I wanted to turn to was the cross appeal. I think that on the cross appeal, what the appellant seeks to do, or the cross appellant, is basically relitigate this case. I think that every issue that she raises is either a novel issue or an issue that was committed to the sound discretion of the trial judge as a question of fact, and one that he resolved against her. He found, in particular, that our client had taken in good faith for a reasonably equivalent value, proving his affirmative defense, and also he found that Ms. Horan was unable to prevail on her claim that it was a fraudulent transfer. And I think that is basically dispositive of their appeal. One thing I did sort of want to point out is that the Uniglob case, which is out of the Northern District of Illinois, is a bankruptcy case, but one that construes Colorado law, I don't think is a particularly well-reasoned case, particularly with its assertion that recording is a transfer for the purposes of the Fraudulent Transfer Act. And I don't think that this issue is properly before this court, but if the court is inclined to reach it on the merits, I would like to point that out, because when you look at the way transfer is defined under the Fraudulent Transfer Act, it basically says it's a mode of parting with an interest in property. And so by that definition, it's clearly the granting of the deed that parts with the transferor's interest in the property. The recording has, by the plain definition under the Recording Act, no bearing on the parties to the transfer. What it dictates is the priorities between the transferee, the person who receives the property, and third parties, third party creditors generally. And so a recording is not a parting with an interest in a property. And so I think that Uniglob's central point on that is just not correct as a matter of Colorado law. And I think what is sort of more at issue, or what Uniglob should have focused on, is the delay. And that it's not the recording, it's when there's a delay between granting and recording a deed. And that's specifically addressed as one of the badges of fraud under the statute.
But vis-a-vis Ms. Horan, as you just pointed out, she knew about the transfer irrespective of your client's recording or non-recording, right? She knew about the transfer to your client. That's how she brought this case.
Right, that is correct. I was just, for the purposes of the cross appellant has basically raised the idea that the trial judge erred by not treating the recording of the deed as a separate transfer independently of the granting of the deed. And my argument is that the recording of the deed can't be a transfer under Colorado law. That's just not right. That distorts the definition of transfer. And what the proper focus on is the delay between recording, which the trial court considered and ultimately didn't find proved that there had been a fraudulent transfer.
So this case presented a rather interesting factual scenario, because after the case went back, the trial court examined the record, the existing record, found a seventh badge of fraud, and then found a presumption that the transfer was fraudulent. And then, following the division's instructions in the prior appeal, it reopened for evidence, and there was new evidence. Is that correct?
I don't think, and I wasn't involved with the trial, I don't think it's so much that it was new evidence. It was more that as the evidence became clarified, it was
there were several additional witnesses who testified, right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And I think what we had not taken into account on the first trial is basically the lien theory statute, which is that regardless of what really the parties meant, right, in the when you give a deed for the purposes of security interest, it establishes a lien in property under the law. And I think that that was the issue, that once we were able to sort of clarify that for the judge, sort of was able to explain what had gone on in this case. I mean, this was a development deal that sort of went south when the economy crashed, and you know, it wasn't one that had been structured by lawyers, and so it was sort of a lot of piecing together what had the parties intended when they weren't exactly aware of how you would actually achieve these things under the plain terms of the law. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve my last couple minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Coleman, registration number 6856. At council table is Kathy Horan, the appellee. First, before any further, Judge Jones, the Haley case, this court stated that a list pendants is not only proper, but I think necessary in a Colorado Fraudulent Transfer Act, which I'm going to refer to just as ACT from now on. The purpose for that is the remedies under Section 108 affect title. They can either set aside the transfer, so you actually change ownership, or they can allow a lien, or they can order the requirement of a number of other aspects that affect the property. So I believe if you were to file a claim under the fraudulent transfer without filing list pendants, you would probably have a defective claim.
Well,
at least you wouldn't get the remedies.
That's if you're claiming an interest in the property.
We always claimed an interest in the property.
As I read your claims, it's a straight breach of contract. You owe me X dollars, and if I win, I want to be able to collect it.
No, the final claim is a direct fraudulent transfer claim. We did.
But you're not seeking to transfer the property back to your client. You're seeking to transfer the property back to somebody else.
No, what we're trying to do is say we have a right in that property.
What's
because
the right?
The property should have been owned by Tricord.
Right, and what's your client's right?
Our remedy is you rescind the transaction, or you create a statutory, under the Act, lien that gives us priority in that property.
What authority do you have for the proposition that a lease pendants is a lien?
Oh, I'm not saying it is a lien.
All right, so
I'm just saying the lien is created upon proof of a fraudulent transfer against the transferor, against Tricord. And all the list pendants says is, all you third parties out there, don't mess with this property during the course of the litigation. Because if you do, whatever rights you claim after this list pendants are going to be subordinate to the outcome of this lawsuit. That's the whole purpose of a list pendant, so that if you three are the judges, we don't fight for 5 years and then find out by sleight of hand they took the property and it's now gone. And that's what they did here.
No. It's not a prejudgment attachment process, and that's how you used it here.
No, I totally agree with you.
You did not. There is no claim in this case by your client for any interest in this property. It is simply, we want our dollars, and if we have to execute against the property, we'll do that. But that's not an interest in the property.
Well, I beg to differ. I think it's a claimed interest in the property, and that's the purpose of
this. What is her interest in the property?
Excuse me?
What is the nature of her legal interest in the property?
The legal interest is that she should not be subject to a fraudulent transfer, and that property should remain in the ownership of
another entity. Another entity, not her.
That's right.
So,
except if they transfer it out, the court order can say, put it back. You can give it, we'd love to have it put back into Tricord so we then can collect against the property.
Exactly.
That's exactly what we want.
Exactly. You want prejudgment attachment.
No.
You see an asset, you've got a claim against somebody, a debtor in this case.
Okay.
You've got a claim against them for dollars. You have no security interest in the property, but you think, well, if I get a judgment, I want to be able to collect it. So I want to make sure they have enough property to collect it. And that's why you file the list pendants.
Okay.
That's prejudgment attachment.
Well, no, that's the reason everyone under the CUFTA Act has to file a list pendants, because the remedy always affects title to real property.
But once you, if you're seeking an interest in real property, you did not, your client did not obtain any interest in the real property.
Well, that's the sort of interesting question here. Against Tricord, the transferor, and remember, list pendants means third parties don't step into our fight. You give it notice, you stay out of here. You can't affect us. We proved against Tricord a fraudulent transfer. Now, under the List Pendants Act, this third party shouldn't have tried to come in and take the res out of the court's jurisdiction. So let's just presuppose they had not done anything. Without a doubt, with the finding of a fraudulent transfer against Tricord, we'd have had that asset. But let me put it in context. This transaction, it's so frustrating because first, they have to assume the promissory note doesn't say what it says. In truth, what happened is Brandon II capitalized a partnership arrangement, and then they agreed. They swore over and over, all we have is a guarantee from three individuals. We have no debt owed by Tricord. And then they go through 4 years of saying, but Tricord conveyed the property to us, and we now own it. 4 years and one day after the final remand hearing, they figured out two things. One, the real estate market had collapsed enough that their debt would now consume the entire property. So if they claim a lien now, they'll get the whole property. So how do we get around the fact that the trial court on June 16 had said for the transfer of ownership, they got no consideration. You lose totally. So they come up with this brand new theory after 4 years, after this court, Judge Bernard, your opinion you wrote in here, you repeatedly referred to these people as owners of the property. Nobody appealed that further. Nobody sought to amend it. They just came up post-trial. And then in the argument, they're saying, how can I defend against it? I didn't even know that theory existed, neither did the trial court, until they submit a trial brief the day after the hearing was concluded. The truth of this case is that this property was always to be Tricord, and my client was satisfied with her position because Tricord had $1.3 million worth of assets, capable of paying $550,000. Unknown to her, well, actually on April 26, Tricord first denies the debt, just out of the blue, and says, no, we're going to deny the debt. We're only going to pay you a little bit of it.
Well, pardon me, Mr. Coleman, but we're past that, right?
Okay. Tricord's
responsibility is now established.
Yes.
And we understand that. So now our concern, obviously, is with the proceedings involving Brandon II. And let me ask you a question about this hearing. I understand your position that Brandon II said that they were the owners, but one of the things that didn't happen the first time that this was up here is that the trial court did not go through the process that the law requires, which is first, is there a presumption of a fraudulent transfer? That burden was on you. But then the trial court did not have the opportunity and did not take the next two steps, which are then the next issue is, well, does the transferee, because at this point the transferor, Tricord, they're off the table because they've deemed to have admitted it all. But does the transferee have anything to say? And that's what the remand was about, wasn't it?
I mean, that's correct.
Okay.
And let me focus then on the remand comes back on, according to your directives. And The court unequivocally finds on June 16 no consideration for the transfer of the titles. Where the trial court confused itself thereafter was whether it was a transfer of fee ownership or transfer of lien ownership. That's what they're giving away. What did they get in return? The court's already said nothing. So if you change from a fee ownership to just a lien ownership, that doesn't change what Tricord received. Zero still remains zero. And where the trial court erred is the trial court did not understand that fraudulent transfers affect transfers of equitable liens too. The court just immediately said, well, we're going to consolidate this whole transaction and we're going to let any unsecured creditor anytime take a security interest in property. And we're going to say because the unsecured status had value, the taking of the lien has value. And the case law is completely to the contrary. Because if you did that, you would never have an unsecured creditor that wouldn't be behind the scenes when things get tight, start taking security for no value. And it defeats the whole purpose of the act.
Well, counsel, you seem to be saying now that your client had an equitable lien against the property? Is that what you're saying?
No, they claimed an equitable lien in the property.
I want to make sure who's claiming a lien here.
Your client,
after the transfer, had no interest in the property.
Oh, she had a Colorado uniform fraudulent transfer interest in the property. And that's what we've debated.
And what case do you have for the proposition that that constitutes an interest in property? You're saying then that anytime I lend money to somebody,
if I lend
money to them, I've got an interest in under CUFTA and all their assets.
Not until there's a fraudulent transfer.
Did you allege a constructive trust should be imposed upon this property?
All we alleged was the remedies under the Colorado Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. And I believe those remedies allow the creation of a lien in our favor. Whether the lien is under a constructive trust, I think is permissible under the fraudulent transfer, and sometimes that is the remedy used. So it sort of leads to it. But the trial court erred in failing to recognize that their claiming of an equitable lien is a transfer governed by the act. The trial court also put the burden on us, said you didn't prove their bad faith. Your opinion repeatedly states the burden is on Brandon too to prove its good faith. They didn't. Insofar as the legitimate business purpose, there is no legitimate business purpose for letting one partner prefer another partner to in effect violate the Partnership Act. That's what the net effect of all this is. If you just applied the law as it's written, no partner can let the other partner come in front and leave a third-party creditor in the cold. Now, on our cross-appeal, I'd like to reserve for my remaining 3 minutes. May I do so?
I don't think so. You better use it right now.
Okay, I will use it right now then. I won't donate it. The list pendants was addressed by the trial court correctly in its January 13, 2012 order. With respect to our claims, the main issues that caused the trouble relate to no value, and they take a valuable lien claim. Whether they took it fee ownership like we thought 2 years ago when we were here arguing the last time, or they take a lien interest. It's a valuable interest in real property for which they gave nothing.
Counsel, is it your position that the Liz pendants still exists?
Yes, the Liz pendants still exists.
The law is that Liz pendants get extinguished by the judgment. You have a judgment, that's your lien, you record the judgment against the property. The Liz pendants goes away. How can it still exist?
Well, I guess that's semantics.
Liz pendants are not liens. Well, that's the law.
I agree. I'm not trying to say they're a lien. They're a notice that if Brandon Two tries to come before this court and say, I did something after the Liz pendants, this court is going to tell them, no, you were put on notice that however this lawsuit ends, it binds you.
Correct. It's a notice.
So what we found was Tricord was guilty of a fraudulent transfer. And remember, the dispute is just between Ms. Horan and Tricord. Because the list pendants affects the Moran property, because it's the only one they took after. So the dispute should have gone just between the non-existent Tricord now and Ms. Horan. And Brandon 2, XYZ, you and I, everybody under the sun was told, if you step into this piece of property, however the lawsuit ends up, Ms. Horan's going to have her rights over your rights. That's all it tells them.
I understand that.
That's all we're asking for.
Because that's all it does. Once you get a judgment that does affect real property, it is the judgment that gets recorded, and the list pendants is of no legal effect at that point.
Well,
you're saying it exists as if it's a lien. That's what you're saying. You're saying it's not a lien, but it has the effect of a lien.
If you negate the list pendants and say it has no effect, and you only give me a right of a judgment as of 2011 or 12.
I'm not talking about the effective date of your judgment. I'm just talking about why the list pendants exists.
It's just notice so that they can't come into court and say we have rights prior to what the judgment says.
Right. And now we're post judgment.
And if we're post judgment, I don't really care. I'll take my Tricord judgment. I want to go against the Moran property,
right,
unaffected by their post litigation transfers. That's all I'm asking for. And I believe that's supported by the case law. But the significant errors we haven't mentioned was the value. The trial court discussed value based upon a Moran contract of 2005. After 2005, there was massive amount of governmental entitlements. The value was much higher. Your opinion clearly told the court, value it as of the dates of transfer, which were April and October. Not 2005. It was worth $1.3 million, and what they have tried to do is, in effect, get all of that $1.3 million value, because the properties have now come down sufficiently in value that they're just going to take it. And that's wrong.
Counsel, I think your time is up, so
okay.
Thank you very much. Helen's counsel has a few more minutes, I believe. If you want to use it, you do not need to. It's up to you.
I think I'll just say that I think you've identified correctly that the earliest Horan could have established an interest in this property is when she achieved her judgment against Tricord, and that you've correctly identified the list pendants issue is not a lien. And so on that, I think I will rest unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.